Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Billy Joe, it's so great to be back on again. This edition, we're going to be talking to our friend of the show, Steve Bladick, who was talking to us about 2 years ago on episode 5. But we're going to change tactics today. We're going to talk about a new form of scholarship for public and helping bring attention, for example, to the Supreme Court.
I think it's terrific that we're getting being able to revisit a former speaker and talk about kind of after the book and how that has really changed his scholarly thinking. And I hope we get time to talk about his newsletter as well.
Yeah, Steve, of course, is at the University of Texas, which is a relatively red or purple state, depending on how you look at it. And, you know, it's interesting for him to be doing sort of this challenging work at the Supreme Court at a time when legal education is increasingly under fire, so to speak. So I look forward to our discussion.
Sounds like a good plan.
Well, Steve, it's so great to talk with you again today. You may recall that you were with us almost exactly 2 years ago, November 19th, 2021. So I think we were still in the throes of COVID, which I say with a little irony as I sit here recovering from COVID. Episode 5 for our listeners in case they'd like to go back. And we wanted to update our listeners because you have been, to put it mildly, incredibly busy with all things scholarly related in your life. And so welcome back to the show.
Great to be back with you, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's talk about, you have a couple of new activities, both your book, which we'll get to later, but I wanted to start off in case our listeners aren't aware of your excellent newsletter that you send out on Monday for all subscribers and then on Thursday for those people like me who pay a small amount to access your wisdom. So let's talk about those newsletters. Tell me about the idea behind it and sort of what you're doing with that.
Sure. I mean, so the newsletter, which is called One First, is basically an effort to make the Supreme Court more interesting and accessible to folks who maybe don't spend all of their days and nights following it. And it grew out of the book in some respects where, you know, it seemed like there was this missing, I don't know, forum, right, for coverage of the court that was not just news coverage, right? I mean, you can find plenty of excellent reporters who will provide day in, day out journalistic coverage of the court from a news perspective. I really wanted to provide more of a institutional story about the Supreme Court. You know, there are, like any institution, there are lots of, I think, interesting, cool, crazy stories about the court that I think many of us law professors actually almost take for granted, but that I think are quite revealing. And so the idea was to blend sort of, you know, coverage of what the court is up to on a weekly basis with a longer, sort of more holistic view of the court as an institution, some parts history, some parts people, some parts trivia, and some parts, you know, sort of breaking down current events. And that was the idea. We launched it about 11 months ago, 10 months ago, and I think it's doing pretty well.
It's been fantastic. I thoroughly enjoy reading them, and I think you have, for the most part, made them very accessible to non-lawyers. As I have mentioned to you privately, I do forward them to my father, who is not a lawyer, and he reads them with great interest. He's particularly interested in the court. So the one today that came out is all about Alabama's basically gerrymandering. And your discussion is really about sort of how Kavanaugh has sort of, I think, painted himself into a corner with the constitutional avoidance doctrine, which of course is a statutory interpretation concept. So I will just say for all the law professors out there, I have used, even though I don't teach con law, I have used many of your newsletters and talked about them in my classes on a regular basis. And then your Thursday one, which is behind the paywall, that one also sort of has some really deep dives in it. So how would a listener go about signing up if they were interested in obtaining a subscription?
Sure. I mean, so the URL is stevevladek.substack.com. And if you add /subscribe, it'll take you right to the subscription page. But if you haven't been there before, it should do that automatically. And I'll say, I mean, you mentioned the Thursday content. You know, I try to have the sort of the general information about the court stuff always be in the Monday issues. And then the Thursday stuff is maybe a little bit more personal and or spicy. But, you know, I mean, I think part of it's just reflective that it takes a lot of time to do the work. And so having folks who are willing to support the newsletter, not just by subscribing, you know, makes it that much easier.
Steve, do you think that time is, there is so much, a lot of content, and so the choice of what is best handled in a newsletter, or do you ever pick up anything from the journalistic side and kind of recast it in your newsletter format?
I feel like, Joe, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, there are weeks where there's just something so obviously in the headlines that to not talk about it seems like it would be sort of not just a disservice, but that whatever I did talk about that week would get ignored. But then there are times where the court's not making a lot of news and where, you know, it's an opportunity to sort of look backward. And so write about old cases, write about old moments. I wrote a few weeks ago about, you know, the switch in time in 1937, which is, of course, this remarkably crazy moment in the court's history. So I really try to vary it. I have sort of a loose list in my head of the latter category of topics of things that, like, I want to get to at some point. And, you know, not in any particular order, Billy Joe, but just sort of when I'm short for content, you know, using that. But, you know, with the term starting 2 weeks from today, as we're recording this, I suspect I'll have lots of current events to fill the newsletter for at least the next little while.
Yeah, so it's interesting that Billy Joe asked you about the time and you mentioned it, because what goes through my head every Monday when I see this is, how do you have the time to do this, to put out a book? I'm sure you're continuing to do, you know, law review and other work. You're continuing your CNN commentary work. Do you sleep? Like, how do you balance all of this?
Not well. You know, I think for me, like, writing is an outlet. And I think that's true for a lot of us. You know, writing is catharsis. And oftentimes, you know, writing about something is how I sharpen my own views about it. So, you know, I won't dispute that some of the newsletters get written Sunday night after the kids are down. I wish I were a little more on top of it in that respect. But I also just think, I mean, you know, I think I've taken a bit of a turn in the last couple of years toward thinking that, like, public education is at least is at least a meaningful part of our job in addition to what we're doing in the classroom. And, you know, there really does seem to be this appetite for, you know, sober, interesting, relevant discussions of the Supreme Court as an institution. I would love it, guys, if there were, you know, sort of a bevy of folks doing this work and I could maybe take a step back. But it feels like it's, you know, it's a gap that needs to be filled. And I have this ridiculous mentality that if no one else is doing it, you know, some things are more important than sleep.
Are you ever surprised by new content or like, wow, I didn't think I'd be writing about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if anything, I've been surprised less by the content and more by the reach. I mean, I get notes from folks about, you know, individual issues on a fairly regular basis, and they're almost all positive, which is actually a nice change from social media. You know, every once in a while, someone's correcting something, which, you know, I love too, because I don't ever want to be wrong about stuff. But, you know, I've had judges tell me they read the newsletter. I may or may not have had a justice tell me they read the newsletter. I mean, you know, it's out there. And I think, you know, Linda, when you say, you know, you use it in your classes, I mean, that's music to my ears. That suggests that it's having the exact impact I was hoping it would.
Well, let's talk about your impact on public education, because your book, you know, certainly a New York Times bestseller book, is not something that's written for a law review audience. It wouldn't have made the New York Times bestseller list had it been. And as someone who's read through it, it's a great read. I highly recommend it. In fact, it will be a Christmas present for my father. He already knows it's coming. We're working on getting Steve to sign it for him. So let's talk about that. First of all, the shadow docket was not your creation for a title, was it? It came from William Bode out of Chicago, but it's pretty accurate. So let's talk about the title to start with.
Sure. I mean, the term is really just, you know, Will coined it, at least as a reference to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2015. Really, it just has this evocative shorthand to try to capture everything that the Supreme Court does other than the merits docket. You know, we're used to thinking in law school that the bulk of the court's work is the 60-ish merits cases the court hands down each term after, you know, briefing and oral argument. And Will's basic insight was that there's actually a lot of really important stuff that happens through the orders list, whether it's grants or denials of certiorari and how the court decides which merits cases it's going to hear, or as we've seen a lot in the last 6 years, grants or denials of emergency relief when a party is asking the justices to intervene before the case, right, gets all the way to them. And, Will's insight was just that, like, we ought to talk about this when we talk about the Supreme Court, because it is often just as important a part of the work the court is doing. And indeed, sometimes it might even be more revealing. And I'll just say, I mean, Linda, as you know, since Will basically sort of coined the phrase in 2015, I think the sort of the use of it has blown up, partly because of shifts in the court's own behavior. You know, I first tried to document those shifts in a piece for the Harvard Law Review Supreme Court issue in the fall of 2019. So this was the issue looking back at the October 2018 term. It was actually while I was writing that piece, which really was a conventional law review type of piece, that it really seemed to me like there was a much bigger story to tell about how the court used and has used orders, right, for a long time as a font of power, and then really trying to put into historical context why the court's behavior over the last 5 or 6 years has been so problematic, right? Why, you know, there's actually still something new and materially different about the current court that we ought to be able to, you know, understand by reference to its predecessors. So, you know, the more I realized there was a book to write, the more it seemed obvious that the audience for that book would not just be our fellow academics, but would be the, you know, folks out there who care about the court, but maybe aren't deeply versed in the distinction between a stay pending appeal and an emergency injunction. And that's what I tried to capture in the book.
So before we go into the contents of the book, let's talk about, you mentioned your Harvard article, but am I correct that the idea for this actually came out of tweeting originally?
Yeah. So, I mean, the tweets were sort of basically this all, I mean, starting in like the summer of 2017, you know, the Trump administration started asking the Supreme Court for emergency relief a lot. And just as an interested observer, it seemed to me worth first documenting how often it was doing that, because it didn't seem like anyone else was. And then second, trying to figure out whether this was new and different. So it really started as just a series of tweets and as a post for SCOTUS blog, which I think is how, you know, I attracted the attention of the student editors of the Harvard Law Review Supreme Court issue. And then once they were interested in having me write about the topic for the, you know, for the Supreme Court review, that's when it really seemed like it was not just a one-off academic project, but something bigger. And I will say, I mean, and I think this is obvious to you guys, but maybe not to folks who are listening. One of the remarkable things about this project is that, you know, with every sort of moment that I'm working on the project, stuff is happening at the court that's giving me more data and more to write about. And, you know, I mean, if anything, like the busiest period for the court when it came to emergency relief was, you know, the fall of 2020 and the winter 2020-2021, by which point I was knee deep in the manuscript, right? So it's a challenge to write about things that are happening in real time, but it also was very both energizing and, you know, in retrospect, it looks like we timed it perfectly, when in fact, I was actually really sort of trying to get this project off the ground before a lot of what's in the book even happened.
So let me ask you, is it fair to say that your point that you're trying to make in this book is that the history of the court used its, let me rephrase that the court used its power, essentially, its cert power and some of the other power, to essentially manipulate its docket, in a way that ultimately helped Republicans? Is that really sort of the thesis of your book, or is that sort of a side point?
So, I mean, I think there are two theses. One is, you know, I think descriptive, And one is, I think, a little more normative, right? So the descriptive thesis, which is, I think, the part that probably everyone who reads it will hopefully agree on, is that the sort of the dramatic shifts in the court's docket starting about 100 years ago, starting with the Judiciary Act of 1925 and continuing throughout the 20th century, were, Linda, for better or for worse, massive transfers of power from the political branches to the court, and massive transfers of power that are reflected in decisions that folks might love or hate, right? That a transfer of power that is not necessarily ideological, right? That's really institutional. And understanding how the Supreme Court came to have as much power as it has today, right? Understanding why, of the 58 cases the court took last term, 57 of them were cases the justices chose. Understanding what that means, right, for the court's institution has very little to do with who the justices are. And so it's just as big a deal when you have a majority that might be appointed by Democratic presidents, right, as we did for a while in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, as with the Republican majority today. So that's the sort of the descriptive part, that like in the move toward the shadow docket comes great institutional power. And indeed, deliberately, at least from the perspective of Chief Justice William Howard Taft. The sort of the more controversial part of the book, where I'm really much more critical, as opposed to a bit ambivalent, is the back half, where I suggest that, you know, although all of that set the stage for the behavior of the court over the last 6 years, a lot of the court's more recent behavior has been far more institutionally problematic, in the sense that the court is not just taking this power out for a spin, but actually it's using the power, Linda, as you put it, in ways that have this remarkable tendency of favoring Republicans and hurting Democrats, in contexts in which the classic defense is the articulation of neutral legal principles that presumably should apply regardless of the partisan valence of the dispute, right? That the reason why we want the court to write opinions is because it's those principles that are articulated in the opinions that separate exercises of judicial power from exercises of political power. When the court isn't explaining itself and it just happens to look like the rulings are being driven by the partisan valence, that's when we start having really serious, to me, legitimacy problems.
Well, Steve, do you think there's an intent, like they actually know what they're doing and are they kind of are taking the ball and running with this in a more orchestrated way rather than just accidental?
So, you know, it's a great question, Billy Joe. I don't think at first any of this was coordinated or planned. I mean, I think, you know, it certainly looks in retrospect and certainly seems in retrospect like a lot of what happened, at least in 2017 and 18 and 19, was just reactive. That the court was hit with a flood of stuff and just never paused and never stopped to reflect on the pretty fundamental shifts that its behavior was, I think, enabling, right? I mean, the court really, I think, sent some signals it might not have meant to send in how solicitous it was, right, of the Trump administration cases. But, you know, Billy Joe, I really do think that by the time we get to the COVID mitigation cases in late 2020 and early 2021, it gets increasingly difficult to take the justices off the hook, right? Because by, you know, February, March, and April of 2021, the justices are resolving through emergency applications pretty major constitutional questions that they simultaneously had pending before them in merits cases. And, you know, not just sort of simultaneously, but that like where they had already voted at conference in the Fulton case, for example, right, on the sort of the future of the free exercise clause. And so, you know, I don't think it started as any kind of deliberate move, but I think that there's a degree to which by early 2021, it was hard to view this as just reactive anymore. And indeed, I mean, as the book tries to suggest, I actually think Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett in particular, you know, sort of took a look back at that in the fall of 2021 and had some misgivings about the court's behavior, which is part of why I think things have actually moderated a smidge right since then. But I, you know, the book is careful about when I, you know, I try really hard to be fair. Yes, the subtitle is How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. But I really try to prove the undermining point. And I think if you read, you know, chapters 5 and 6, which look at the COVID cases and then the election cases, I think are really the best evidence we have that this is more than just knee-jerk reactions by justices, at least in some of these cases.
Yeah, it's interesting. Chapter 5, where you talk about the use of COVID to essentially expand the religious liberty doctrine that the court had. Basically, the court's always been all over the place on religious, the First Amendment issues. And then it used COVID as a way of sort of allowing a lot more religious, respect, freedom, whatever you want to call it. Did you have a chapter, you have 7 chapters here. Did you have one that you particularly enjoyed writing or that you were particularly kind of surprised by, maybe using Billy Joe's words, but which one was your favorite?
Chapter 3, the death penalty chapter. I mean, not favorite is sort of an awkward word because it's so depressing and demoralizing, but it was a turning point for me in working on the book because chapter 3 is really the bridge from the past to the present. You know, Linda, I had a pretty good idea when I sat down to write the book of where the story was going to start and where it was going to end, but I really hadn't figured out the middle. And I didn't fully appreciate until I really started trying to piece things together just how remarkable an impact the return of the death penalty had on the Supreme Court as an institution in the late 1970s and 1980s. And just how much the court really changed its behaviors institutionally to respond to the flood of emergency applications in capital cases that the court was responsible for, right? That the court was doubly responsible for, first by bringing back the death penalty with a whole bunch of new constitutional claims, and second by having a series of procedural doctrines that prevented those claims from being raised until the 11th hour. And so, you know, when Justice Alito, you know, gives a speech that says, we've always done this, right? You know, I wanted to really take that claim seriously and figure out how far back the court's recent behavior goes. And it turns out that, you know, if this is, you know, having the full court resolve emergency applications without briefing and argument and without much of an explanation, yeah, that goes back to the death penalty cases of the early 1980s. It's just that for the better part of 35 years that had stayed over there in the death penalty space, being able to write that, like being, you know, I had sort of a couple of light bulb moments as I'm writing this chapter, really helped me to figure out like where, you know, what the connective tissue was between the sort of the slow accumulation of power over the court's docket and the much more aggressive accumulation of power over emergency applications, you know, in the last 6-7 years.
I guess Linda's question begs a question for me, like, is there a book 2 or a chapter you didn't get to write?
I mean, there are, I mean, so one of the, depending on your perspective, either upsides or downsides of writing for a popular press is that you're under a few more constraints than if it were an academic book. And so I was under a very, very strict word count diet that I still almost violated. I don't think that there was an entire chapter of Billy Joe that I didn't get to write. I think if I had known how much the ethics stuff was going to blow up after the book came out, I might have spent a little more time talking about, you know, the justice's sort of personal behavior, you know, the impeachment of Justice Samuel Chase, the resignation of Justice Fortas, you know, those sort of historical examples. I do think, I mean, if there is a second book here, I think it is a separation of powers book about how the court historically was held accountable by the political branches through all kinds of, you know, soft and hard checks and levers, and the consequences of, to me at least, the sort of the demise of that accountability and the disappearance of that accountability. So that, you know, I mean, we had Justice Alito in July tell the Wall Street Journal that he doesn't think Congress has the power to regulate the court, period. That's a remarkable sentiment if you have any appreciation of the Supreme Court's history. But I think, you know, this is not coming out of thin air, right? I mean, that at least this court has not been and therefore does not feel beholden to Congress. And that, I think, is very much responsible, not just for the rise of the shadow docket, but for many of the other, I think, issues that are circling around the court today.
I thought there might be some empirical scholars that would see some data projects or drilling down in some of that.
So they're
you get contacts like that?
Yeah, no, I mean, so I'm aware of at least three or four scholars who are trying to do, you know, really good empirical work on the shadow docket. Turns out it's really hard. You know, my initial reaction when I first started trying to collect data and thought that it was impossible or at least beyond my limits as a scholar have kind of been validated by some of my exchanges with these folks, because it turns out that the Supreme Court does not do a very good job of, keeping data. And, you know, even with access to powerful commercial databases that, you know, most of us have, really hard to code for this stuff in ways that just doesn't create massive amounts of noise. You know, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of applications filed every term that are just frivolous, or at least, or in the other direction, entirely routine, like an application for an extra 30 days to file a cert petition. Those are granted as a matter of course, right? Those should not count, but what's our rationale for not counting them, right? So just trying to figure out how to both collect the data and then code it turns out to be a really big challenge. I will say the folks who have done it, you know, we don't have exactly one-to-one parity in our data, but the patterns are very, very similar. I mean, I've been very sort of nervous that folks are going to find that better empiricists are going to find sort of better data that actually is inconsistent with the book, and actually everything I've seen backs it up, where, you know, the patterns are effectively undeniable. And frankly, I mean, Billy Joe, I did a number of interviews for the book, mostly on background. But you talk to folks who clerked at the Supreme Court, right, in the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s. Death cases are what they remember about the shadow docket, right? And so, you know, getting the numbers exactly right is a challenge because of how the court codes data. The broader themes, I think, are not. But just one really, really dumb example of how hard it is to collect good data on the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court itself runs its data based on docket numbers. And so for the Supreme Court, a case is filed in the October 2023 term if it has a 23 docket number. But the court resets its docket numbers in June, so 3 months before the new term starts. So there have been cases over the summer, right, that have had 23 docket numbers that the court decided during its October 2022 term. There's a really funny, I mean, I think funny, there's a really illuminating article in the Green Bag by Judge John Newman on the Second Circuit about how the Supreme Court can't even count its own docket correctly. And I think there's a larger story here, which is that, you know, this is people who are critical of me, right, often say, well, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. It's all on the website. I mean, you can find this all. And my point is, like, yes, it's not literally classified. It's not literally inaccessible, but it is pretty practically inaccessible. Just, you know, if the Supreme Court is deciding a pending emergency application, the court's decision could show up on any one of five different pages on the Supreme Court's website, and you'd never know in advance which one to check. Like, there's nothing routinized about this. There's nothing easy about this. And that's, you know, I think consistent with the broader point of just how hard it is to track, right, what the court is doing holistically.
Well, those are going to be interesting articles when they come out. Let's turn to chapter 7, where you quote, if I'm not mistaken, it was Amy Comey Barrett, the read the opinion, as a way of sort of bringing it all together. What led you to sort of use that as your sort of organizing principle for that chapter?
So, I mean, again, right, this is a speech she gave, like, while I was writing the book. And so, you know, it's sort of, I wanted to almost send a thank you note, like, you know, thank you for giving me the title of my last chapter. Just like Justice Kagan's dissent in the SB8 case, right, which gave me basically the epigraph. So, you know, the Barrett speech, I think, is actually not an outlier, Linda. I think a number of the justices across the court's history have, you know, adopted a similar view and a similar argument about the court's legitimacy. That, you know, we should not be judging the court by the bottom lines. We should be judging the court by the principles that the justices are articulating. This is the joint opinion in Casey in 1992, right? That principled justifications are the source of the court's legitimacy. And I think Barrett's version was just a slightly pithier version of that, which is the idea that, like, what separates the court from the political branches is actually its ability to provide principled justifications for its decision making. Linda, not because you and I are going to agree with the principles the justices espouse, but hopefully we will at least agree that they are principles. And, you know, what's missing when the court is issuing unsigned, unexplained orders that have these massive real-world downstream effects is that principled decision-making. And I think in the context of the Barrett speech, that's especially revealing because she gave that speech less than 48 hours before a 5-4 decision putting back into effect a Trump-era, you know, environmental rule, in which hers was the decisive vote, but there was no opinion to read, right? So that's the, you know, it's just, there's a degree to which the justices are sort of saying one thing and doing the other that I think drives home how, you know, even they are not defending the behavior that they're engaging in. They're just, in some respects, denying that they're doing it.
So you mentioned earlier, and I sort of have a bit of the sense that it does seem to be getting better. So let's talk about that. I mean, is it getting better because of your New York Times bestseller list? Is it getting better because of your tweets? Is it getting better because just the fact that the court's a little bit more aware of it now maybe is making them a little more cautious? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean,
what is better, by the way? What does better mean?
So better means that I think the court is doing less of what I thought was the most alarming of its behavior between 2017 and 2021. We're seeing fewer of these orders that are dividing justices into rigid ideological camps. We're seeing the court decide fewer big questions just entirely on the emergency docket. Take the student loan cases, for example. I mean, as bad as the principal decision was, you know, the court, I think, knew enough to know that it couldn't do that as a unsigned, thinly explained order, that it actually punted that to the merits docket. We've seen more of that. You know, I think we've seen the court have sort of interventions through emergency applications, Linda, that have looked less ideological, like in the Mifepristone case, where Justices Alito and Thomas were the only public dissenters from the stay blocking, you know, Judge Kaczmarek's injunction against Mifepristone. I think the justices are trying a little bit more to explain themselves, although even that, I think, is getting honored in the breach. I mean, the most recent big shadow docket ruling, at least as we record this, was on the Biden administration's ghost guns rule, where the court voted 5-4 to put the rule back into effect, but there was nary a word of explanation from either the majority or the dissenters as to why. And so, you know, I don't think we're there, but I think it's sort of, you know, things have calmed down a bit. I mean, you know, we're a couple weeks away from the end of this term. We're not going to have nearly as many emergency applications granted this term as we did last term or the term before. And so I think, you know, better might be sort of a bit weird. Things are calming down a bit. As for why, you know, I don't think it's the book. I mean, I'd love it if they said so. You know, I think it's that this whole conversation is just, it's in the water. And, you know, that was happening well before the book came out. I mean, Justice Kagan, her dissent in the SB8 case, I think, really went a long way. Public reaction in September and October of 2021 to what the court was doing, I think, went a long way. And to me, the moral there is not that, you know, we should be writing more books about the Supreme Court. The moral is that, like, public pushback matters and actually can still have an effect, even as I think there are folks who would deny that that's either appropriate or legitimate. I mean, I think here's a pretty powerful example of at least some of the justices moderating their behavior in response to, right, public pushback and criticism.
So you mentioned Kagan's dissent in that one case twice, and just for our listeners who aren't as familiar with it as you are, as I recall, she called out the court for the shadow docket, but I don't remember exactly what she said. Do you remember?
So she said, this was about whether the court should block Texas's 6-week abortion ban from going into effect 9 months before Dobbs. This is while Roe is still a good law. And by a 5-4 vote, the court refused to block it. And Kagan, in a very, very sharp dissent, described the majority's ruling as emblematic of this court's shadow docket decision-making, which every day becomes more unreasoned, inconsistent, and impossible to defend. And there are two real charges there, which I think both require sort of, you know, unreasoned and inconsistent, right? Like those, to me, go hand in hand. Because at least if they were consistent, right, I think we wouldn't have quite the same level of objection to them. What made the SB8 case so remarkable, besides the politics of abortion, is that this was the exact same 5-4 split. that we had seen over and over again earlier in 2021 going the other way to block state COVID mitigation measures on novel religious liberty grounds, right? In contrast to the court that sort of sat on its hand and said, oh, there are procedural questions getting in the way of us blocking this Texas abortion law, right? That's the inconsistent part of that charge, I actually think, is the most damaging, because inconsistency is what gives the appearance that what the justices are doing is just voting up and down on things they like and don't like, as opposed to acting like judges.
It's odd that you say that, because I, every year of my life, have taught introduction to legal research, and I always spend a significant amount of time about the precedential value of cases and why and what that means. And this year, for the first time, it was like, well, is that still really true? Because they've had enough newsworthy episodes that maybe we're not following precedent in the way to make people have some assurance of an outcome. And maybe the court is a bit worried about that or not.
You know, I mean, the court is a they, not an it, right? And so I think different of the justices are probably worried about this to different degrees. You know, I think precedent still has a leveraging effect, even in the cases in which the court doesn't follow it, right? I mean, and Billy Joe, I mean, as you know as well as anyone, you know, precedent certainly has a vertical effect where, you know, lower courts and parties, you know, feel bound by it, even when this, even with a Supreme Court that might be inclined to not be bound by it. So, you know, I think it's still the case that precedent matters. But if anything, that's why this is all such a big deal, because when the court uses emergency applications to signal that maybe it's interested in revisiting precedent, right, that has some, I don't know, some destabilizing effects that would be, I think, mitigated by full-throated explanations by the justices. Because now it's not just destabilizing from the perspective of people like us who sit back and try to look at the court from afar, right? But if you're a lower court judge, or if you're, you know, the governor of California, you're trying to figure out, like, what am I supposed to do in light of this unsigned, unexplained Supreme Court order that has this effect? You know, even the best, even the most sort of neutral, objective folks in those positions are going to struggle if the court is saying nothing, but turning around and expecting folks to read into its nothing, right? Some kind of something.
So we are fast approaching the end of our time. Let's talk about, as we move out back into sort of the talking legal ed concept, you're now a New York Times bestselling author. You walk into class. How has your life changed with your students, or has it?
I really don't think it has. You know, the something about the New York Times bestseller list is it does not really change what kind of person you are. I think the only change is that there's now one extra line on my bio. But, you know, I think the real point, what a wonky sort of procedural book about the Supreme Court getting on the bestseller list should tell us is a lot more about the court than about me, right? And a lot more about sort of public interest in the court at this moment than anything about the author. And that, Linda, is what I see reflected in my classes, right? That, like, these are students who are deeply invested in understanding what the court is doing right now that they just disagree with versus what the court's doing right now that is sort of institutionally different from its predecessors versus what the court's doing right now that could fairly be described as, you know, illegitimate or lawless, because those are not all the same thing. And I'll just say that I think, you know, to me, the most gratifying thing about the book is not, you know, any of those sort of external metrics, but rather just that what they reflect, which is that people really are interested in these kinds of institutional accounts of the Supreme Court. And more of us should hopefully take a lesson from that, that, like, we shouldn't just be writing about the cases, right? That writing about the docket is actually important. Writing about the budget is important. Writing about ethics is important. And I think, you know, for too long, too many of us had fallen into the trap that the principal thing of interest about the Supreme Court was its merits docket. It's not that that's not interesting, but it's not the whole story. And that's really what I think I meant to accomplish in the book. And I think that's where this kind of public reaction and, you know, classroom reaction, I think, reflects that.
Well, so what about the fact that you're in an incredibly red state writing a book like this? How's that going?
Yeah, interesting time to be in Texas. I will just say, because I'm required to say this, it's an incredibly red state insofar as our political leadership. It's actually purplish if you look at, you know, statewide elections. I mean, Trump won, you know, only by about 10 points, right, in 2020. So 55-45, it's just not reflected anywhere. I will say, you know, the University of Texas, I mean, all of our 36 public colleges and universities survived the most recent legislative session really by the skin of our teeth. There was a pretty concerted effort to go after tenure at Texas colleges and universities. A bill got out of the Texas Senate that would have basically gotten rid of tenure. You know, that got watered down in the House so that what finally passed really wasn't basically anything other than codifying our existing tenure policies into state law. But, you know, it's a sign of the times. And, you know, I hope that folks like me who are doing visible work that is inconsistent with the political preferences of our statewide leadership don't become focal points for any of what the legislature is doing. But it's a lot easier for me as a very visible, tenured, chaired, you know, white male professor at the law school to be public and say things that are critical of the governor, lieutenant governor, the attorney general, than, you know, unchaired, untenured women, you know, professors of color, maybe at smaller schools in Texas. And so, you know, I'm less worried on a day-to-day basis about how this affects me directly, Linda, and I'm much more worried about how it affects my colleagues. Because I think, you know, for every one of me, there are a handful of folks who don't feel nearly as well protected to do and say what they want to do and say.
Am I right that Texas is Texas, but Texas is not Florida?
We're doing our best, though. I mean, yes, like at least to this point, you know, we have not quite gone full Florida. But Billy Joe, that's really as much because of, I mean, our state legislature is kind of backwards. It's the Senate in Texas that's really quite radically far right. And the House is a bit more moderate, at least relative to the Senate. And I think, you know, had the Texas Senate had its way, we'd look very much like Florida. And so my concern in the long term, I mean, is yes, we weathered this storm, but what about the next one?
Well, yeah, maybe the next book one of us ought to be writing is about the politics and education, right? Because that really should be, I mean, it's just kind of stunning the changes that have happened.
And the extent to which like it's become accepted in large chunks of our society that there is nothing like blatantly inappropriate about, you know, politicizing public education.
And it is a little scary, no doubt about it. Well, I hate that we've come to the end of our hour. We will do our best to put the link both to your newsletter and also to your book online to the extent that our editor knows how to do that. I'm sure he does. I don't, but we will make sure to get those up. Thank you so much, Steve, for your time today and for coming back to see us again. And you just are going gangbusters. And, you know, for God's sakes, we'll probably be back again in 2 years at your rate.
Yeah. Always the best, well, Steve.
I really appreciate you guys having me on. And I, you know, as you guys know, I mean, I think there's so much that is so dynamic about legal education. And I just think that the more we talk about its dynamism, the more I think we are cementing the importance of everything that we do. So I'm grateful to you guys for doing this.
Have a good week with the girls.
You too.
Thanks so much for listening. We look forward to speaking with you again in our next episode of Talking Legal Ed.
Talking Legal Ed is produced by David Ritchie in association with Panopticon Media. Editing by Tim Spieshock and artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts.